In continuation, God says, after it becomes sure for them, meaning the believers, that they, in other words, these polytheists, are the inhabitants of hell. Right? So the converse of this, obviously, is that if we're not sure about it, why not? We can ask forgiveness for them. There's no problem. There's no problem in it. And, you know, the most glaring instance and case of this is after this person dies. Obviously, after we know that after a person dies, after a human being dies, the doors of repentance are closed to a person, right? The doors of repentance are open for a person up to death, the time of death. After that, you know, forgiveness is not accepted by God. So after a person dies, after a non-Muslim dies, we can't say that, oh God, please forgive this person. Please forgive my relative who died and was a non-Muslim. Forgive him. Don't send him to hell. This would be impermissible for us. But up to that point, yeah, why not? We can ask forgiveness for them and ask God to guide them to the straight path. Now, this is specifically, and a very important point here we want to make is that this is specifically, the topic we're talking about is specifically asking forgiveness for the non-Muslim, right? Istighfar, asking forgiveness from this, which comes from the verse that we were talking about. But the verse doesn't say anything else about other types of prayers, praying for them in other ways, for other reasons. In fact, right, we have a prayer in the famous book of prayers, the Sahifa Sajjadiyyah, in which the Imam asks and prays for non-Muslims, right? Not forgiveness, asking for forgiveness for them, but ask God, you know, for other things, you know, with respect to everybody. It's a general prayer. For example, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, Allahumma aghni kulla faqir. Oh God, you know, make every poor person self-sufficient. Doesn't say make every poor Muslim self-sufficient. Or he says, Allahumma ashbi kulla ja'e. Please feed, oh Allah, please feed every hungry person. Doesn't say hungry non-Muslim or hungry Muslim. Thank you for joining us here on the key. We were looking at the permissibility of praying for non-Muslims in the verses of the Holy Quran and the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime perpetrates the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading UN Expert Says Zionist Regime Practices Apartheid Against Palestinians. Here's more. The Zionist regime perpetrates the crime of apartheid against Palestinians, and third states should support accountability efforts at international courts. So states Michael Link, an independent United Nations human rights expert from Canada, in a new report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva recently. Last year, that body voted in favor of establishing a permanent commission of inquiry into the Zionist regime's violations of Palestinian rights in all the territory under its control, including inside the 1949 armistice line, demarcating the Zionist regime from the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime is nervous that the commission, led by three experts, whose report is expected to be published in June, will characterize it as an apartheid regime, according to a foreign ministry cable seen by the news publication Axios. Link's new periodic report as a special rapporteur to the UN Human Rights Council follows a handful of studies from high-profile Israeli and international human rights organizations concluding that the Zionist regime practices apartheid against Palestinians mainstreaming and aspects of what their Palestinian counterparts have been saying about the Zionist regime rule for decades. Acknowledging the seeming performance of the Zionist regime's military occupation, human rights groups are also calling for an approach centered on rights and accountability rather than moribund peace process towards a two-state solution championed by the United Nations and other entities complicit in the prolonged situation of injustice in Palestine. The Zionist regime has refused to cooperate with the Human Rights Council Commission of Inquiry and has denied entry and boycotted Link and experts who have previously held the role of a special rapporteur for human rights in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Link notes that, consistent with the mandate of the special rapporteur, his periodic report focuses on Israeli practices in the West Bank, including East al-Quds and Gaza. As such, he does not examine policy towards Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories or Palestinian refugees in exile, but acknowledges that Palestinian, Israeli, and international groups have concluded that it is impossible to have democracy here and apartheid there. Link observes that, by their very nature, occupations are required to be built with wood, not concrete. With the establishment of 300 Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank since 1967, and a massive wall built mostly on Palestinian land in the same territory, the Zionist regime occupation has involved a great amount of concrete. Meanwhile, in Gaza, for the past 15 years, Palestinians there have been barricaded into an open-air prison, Link states, adding a method of population control unique in the modern world. People in Gaza have endured four highly asymmetrical wars with the Zionist regime during that time, with enormous loss of human life and immense property destruction. The Zionist regime leaders have regularly and openly proclaimed that the regime's rule over the Palestinians and their land is permanent and that no Palestinian state will emerge, Link adds. The intent is for the Palestinians to be encased in a political ossuary, a museum relic of 21st century colonialism. The human rights expert observes that an institutionalized regime of systematic racial oppression is at the heart of the Zionist regime's settler colonial project in Palestine. For example, Israelis residing in Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank enjoy comprehensive rights, while Palestinians in the same territory live under military rule and control. The Zionist regime settlement enterprise is meanwhile meant to demographically engineer an unlawful sovereignty claim through the annexation of territory. And because it is impossible for a colonial power to expropriate land and resources for its own population without also immiserating the indigenous people and triggering their perpetual rebellion, the Zionist regime has imposed increasingly harsh methods of control over Palestinians. The Zionist regime's practices against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza therefore pass the test of applicability of an international legal definition of apartheid, Link states. He observes that only the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, adopted by the UN General Assembly in 1973, the Rome Statute providing the foundation of the International Criminal Court, drafted 25 years later, provide legal definitions for apartheid. A contemporary legal definition of apartheid drawn from and consistent with both the Convention and the Rome Statute would stipulate there exists an institutionalized regime of systematic racial oppression and discrimination, established with the intent to maintain the domination of one racial group over another. and which features inhumane acts committed as an integral part of the regime. All three features must be fulfilled for a situation to be considered one of apartheid. Link adds, examples or patterns of racial discrimination by themselves are insufficient. The social construction of racial identity should be seen as a matter of perception, particularly in the eyes of a dominant group that distinguishes itself from other groups based on social markers such as nationality, ethnicity, religion, ancestry, and descent, Link says. In the case of the Zionist regime and the Palestinians, the former has determined the allocation and the denial of the rights in the occupied Palestinian territory through a series of laws, practices, and policies which define who is a Jew and who is not a Jew, according to Link. Under this system, the freedoms of one group are inextricably bound up in the subjugation of another. Palestinian human rights group welcomed Link's seminal report, the first by UN Special Rapporteur to definitely state that the Zionist regime practices apartheid. Unsurprisingly, the Zionist regime officials rejected Link's findings. Mehrabi Elion Sahar, the Zionist regime permanent representative to the United Nations in Geneva, accused the independent expert of recycling baseless and outrageous libels. She added that Link aims to delegitimize and criminalize the regime of Israel for what it is, the state of Jewish people with equal rights for all citizens, she baselessly claimed. As Link notes in his report, however, the 5 million Palestinians under the Zionist regime military occupation are stateless and living without rights, in an acute state of subjugation and with no path to self-determination. And as for the more than 1.5 million Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, the lie of democracy is dispelled by Benjamin Netanyahu, whose office as prime minister ended last year after more than a decade, saying Israel is not a state of all citizens, but the state of Jewish people and them alone. Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. President Joe Biden has stirred up controversy after suggesting that his country could lead the world. Speaking at a business roundtable meeting, Joe Biden referred twice to, quote, a new world order. The phrase quickly became a trending topic on social media on Monday. On the surface, a new world order means a dramatic paradigm shift in international affairs and a change in the balance of power at the global scale. But what the U.S. president didn't consider when uttering those words was the connotation they carry with them. New World Order has for years been used by conspiracy theorists to mean a situation in which a secret cabal of governments take matters into their own hands to form a multinational totalitarian and oppressive regime. Which definition Biden might have been going for is beside the point. The main issue is that he took it upon himself to lead the world. The statement is a fundamental rejection of the world's multipolarity.
We have to always bear in mind that those who are in power, the hegemonic powers of the world, in particular the United States and their European allies, as well as the Zionist entity, they're always planning and always plotting, if you want to use that word, on how to further increase, how to maintain, how to strengthen, how to bolster the power that they already have.
How can the U.S. and its Western allies sideline their rivals, including Russia and China, that are superpowers? The West has been announcing new sanctions against Russia since it began its special military operation into Ukraine. Russia's financial and energy sectors have been under the West's crosshairs.
We are determined to continue to impose costs on Russia to bring about the end of this brutal war.
But Russia was already under sanctions before the conflict even started. This has had many speculating that the West might have been looking for an excuse to increase pressure on Moscow.
These people in power, and I'm talking specifically the United States here, they are trying to get rid of these hurdles, which they consider to be very bothersome impediments to their power projection. So the United States at this moment is trying to completely get rid of the national sovereign powers that still exist in the world. For example, Russia, China, Iran, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, you know, all sorts of countries that are refusing to bow down and to accept the globalist world order. These countries are now in particular being targeted.
But such pressure would backfire at those imposing them too. The most basic example is the EU's reliance on Russian energy. At a time when the bloc faces an energy crisis and soaring consumer prices, sanctioning a major producer of gas, oil, and wheat doesn't seem like a sound plan. Russia isn't sitting idly by. Moscow has been planning initiatives to cushion the blow of sanctions on its economy. President Vladimir Putin announced this week that his country has drawn up a list of, quote, unfriendly countries that need to pay for their energy purchases from Russia in rubles. U.S. President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office, promising to bring back diplomacy and to reverse his predecessor's misguided policies. 14 months into his presidency, however, he is following in the footsteps of the Donald Trump administration. How much longer will it take for the U.S. to realize that the unipolar world is no more?
U.S. President Joe Biden has claimed that his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin's back is against the wall and that the Russian leader did not anticipate the strength of NATO's unity in supporting Ukraine. This is despite Ukraine's president Volodymyr Zelensky lashing out on a regular basis against the North Atlantic Alliance's lack of support for his country in the face of Russia's military operation. Nevertheless, Biden claims Russia's accusations that Kiev has biological and chemical weapons means Putin is considering using them himself in the Ukraine conflict. The White House has not provided any evidence to support Biden's claims.
Turn the tables around and begin to accuse the accuser, so to speak. This is a classic case, classic situation. So now they, rather than sort of trying to justify themselves, what these labs were doing there, why were they sponsored, what kind of research they were doing, they turn the tables around and say that Russians want to use it as a pretext for some attack.
A senior American defense official speaking to reporters on condition of anonymity has acknowledged that Washington has no concrete information of a Russian chemical or biological weapons attack. It just happens that Biden's accusation comes after Russian forces stumbled on what Moscow says are U.S.-funded biological research facilities near the Russian border, and asked the White House to explain why it financed a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens. It's not the first time America has leveled accusations concerning the use of chemical weapons as a pretext to militarily intervene in other countries. Perhaps the biggest example is the case of Iraq, where American officials presented alleged intelligence that Baghdad was in possession of weapons of mass destruction, which led to the disastrous US-led invasion of Iraq that killed more than 1 million Iraqis. In Syria, Washington and its Western allies claimed the Syrian government used chemical weapons, and America attacked the Arab country despite evidence later emerging that terrorists who the Syrian government had been fighting were the ones who staged the false flag operations. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons even announced the Syrian government's chemical stockpile had been destroyed. There are now concerns Washington will use similar false flag operations in Ukraine.
Really inhumane thing to do. A, you know, it's immoral in terms of kind of lying and trying to blame the other side for your own faults, for your own, you know, sins. But another one, it will just simply escalate the whole thing, because to make this kind of fake attack will probably poison and destroy people, and it will just strengthen Russian resolve and Russian anger. So
Biden says that Putin knows there'll be severe consequences because of what he described as a united NATO front, but did not specify what actions the alliance would take. Some cracks have appeared in the NATO alliance, in particular among European countries.
NATO already did all it could. I don't think it will come down, to some kind of exchange of nuclear arms. But I think it's basically we continue in this war of, in the court of public opinion. So the idea and the purpose of the NATO is very simple: to justify their existence, that they're good, they're a force of goodness, as opposed to their opponents, be it Syria, be it Iran, be it Russia. Their opponents are so bad that they are willing to utilize every nasty thing in the book, and that's what we want to do. So it'll be a victory primarily psychological.
In such cases, the issue of timing tends to come up. Biden's remarks come amid peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. The talks haven't been as smooth as many would wish. Nevertheless, there are negotiations which, for some odd reason, the Biden White House is not supporting. And that leads to the question as to why America and some of its Western allies are not backing the ongoing efforts to end this conflict peacefully.
With the conflict between Russia and Ukraine ongoing for over 3 weeks, Turkey is playing a significant role to de-escalate the tensions. The country is hosting high-level discussions between the two sides aimed at reaching a ceasefire, expressing readiness to host talks between the presidents of Ukraine and Russia. In the meantime, reports suggest that the United States has informally suggested that Turkey send its Russian-made S-400 missile defense systems to Ukraine to help Kiev with its fight against Russian forces.
The report suggests that American officials have floated the idea with their Turkish counterparts, but no formal request was made. The idea was also mentioned during Deputy State Secretary Wendy Sherman's visit to Turkey earlier this month. That seems too convenient for the U.S. and its Western allies that have been asking Turkey to abandon its Russian-made air defenses and instead use American-made Patriot counterparts.
Yes, it's exactly the same system that they complained about earlier, but the political geometry has changed a little bit, so the United States is trying to turn things around to try and bring Turkey closer and to separate it a little more from Russia and to overcome the debacle for the U.S. that the Turkey's purchase of these missiles created earlier.
Observers say Turkey will almost certainly reject the proposal, but the fact that it's even being offered reveals the West's opportunistic policies. Turkey signed a multi-billion dollar agreement to acquire several batteries of Russia's S-400 missile defense system in 2017. The West wasn't pleased with the deal, arguing that installing such systems in a NATO country would potentially compromise the security of the military alliance, as well as pose a risk to the newly developed F-35 fighter jets. The first batch of the Russian-made system was delivered to Turkey in 2019, enraging the West. Former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed sanctions on Turkey over the incident and cut Ankara, a financial and manufacturing partner, from the F-35 program. Turkey has demanded repayment of some $1.4 billion it put into the program, but so far hasn't received anything back. Turkey stresses that it opted for the Russian system as the Western-made counterparts were not offered to it at agreeable terms. The U.S. suggestion that Ankara send its S-400 missile defense system to Ukraine to shoot down Russian fighter jets, apart from the technical hurdles of delivering and installing them, would potentially risk a Russian blowback. Washington has certainly predicted that any deterioration of ties between Ankara and Moscow could harm Turkey's position as a neutral broker and derail the ceasefire talks. That raises some serious questions about the U.S. stated willingness to end the conflict in Ukraine as soon as possible.
The spokesman for Yemen's armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari', says Sana'a has staged a fresh retaliatory operation against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a bid to break the all-out blockade Riyadh has imposed on its southern neighbor. Yahya Sari' noted that targets in Saudi Arabia's port city of Jeddah, as well as Jizan, have been struck in the third phase of special operations. Earlier, Sari' announced the second phase, saying Yemeni forces had conducted major operations, which he described as special in nature, and that the mission had been carried out successfully. He pointed out the large-scale operation has been staged with a batch of ballistic missiles and drones. According to the spokesman, Phase 2 involved projectiles flying across the border, targeting a number of vital and sensitive sites in the regions of Abha, Khamis Umshayat, Jizan, and Samata, as well as southern Tehran, with facilities belonging to Saudi oil giant Aramco among the sites targeted. Saudi state media acknowledged a barrage of drone and missile attacks. Despite the kingdom claiming to have intercepted the projectiles, it later reported that drones had hit a petroleum distribution terminal, a natural gas plant, and an oil refinery that led to a temporary reduction in the refinery's production levels. On March 11, Sari' announced the first phase of this operation, which also included the bombing of a number of vital and sensitive Saudi facilities affiliated with Aramco in Riyadh, among other areas. He has stressed that the operations come within the framework of Yemen's legitimate right to respond to what he labeled as an unjust siege According to UN experts, the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen is having a catastrophic effect on millions of people.
The Yemenis have suffered a lot because they cannot import even food or medicine. And the past 70 years have been hell to the Yemenis. And it is now seven painful years for them, and the world is just watching.
Saria has pledged that the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more military operations in the not-so-distant future to break the siege, warning Riyadh the upcoming retaliatory attacks will include sensitive targets that are beyond the imagination of the Saudis. The Saudi war on Yemen is on the brink of its seventh anniversary. On March 26, 2015, Riyadh and a number of its regional allies, backed by the United States, declared war on Yemen. Riyadh said the offensive would take a couple of weeks to achieve its goals, one of which was to restore the former government in Sana'a, whose term had expired but was loyal to the Saudis. However, 7 years later, analysts say the kingdom and its allies, including Washington, have underestimated the determination and the steadfastness of the Yemeni forces and nation to seek sovereignty from Saudi rule. In normal warfare, Saudi Arabia would have the upper hand in this war. Riyadh enjoys unwavering support from the West, in particular the United States. Washington has provided logistical and intelligence backing to the Saudi Air Force, while the UK has trained Saudi pilots. But the real support has come in the form of arms sales. America and its Western allies have sold the Saudis advanced weapons to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, making a massive profit. Despite warnings by rights groups of Western complicity in war crimes amid an indiscriminate Saudi bombardment campaign that has killed women and children, Western weapons continue to flow into the kingdom. Despite all this support, the question is, after 7 years, why can't Saudi Arabia win its war on Yemen?
They do not have legitimate goals by waging the war. Number two, their people, their soldiers have become demoralized because of their inability to score victories over the Yemenis. And thirdly, the Yemenis are known historically for their power.
Under a tight blockade, Yemeni forces have manufactured their own indigenous ballistic missiles and drones. Despite their relatively low costs in comparison with Saudi weapons, they have proven very effective. Yemeni officials say they have no choice but to expand retaliatory operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia, with the goal of forcing Riyadh to end its blockade and to end its air raids.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Man has been created to achieve perfection, to work hard to live a better life, to endeavor to achieve a better life. Perfection is the ultimate purpose for which God has created humanity and human beings, and on the way to perfection, human beings are equipped with desire. All have some degree of self-love. Every individual has some degree of self-love. So they desire and make efforts for their well-being, for a better future, for a better life, and yet they often make mistakes in deciding what is really better for them. Because sometimes human beings are overwhelmed by their instincts, by their physical desires. It makes it very difficult for the human being to understand what is in his best interest. But human beings have the power to follow the path to perfection. Human beings are not like any other creatures. Human beings can understand facts and decide what to do and what is in his best interest. He's not like other creatures to move on with the help of their instincts. Human beings can resist sin, and human beings can choose not to commit sins. There are different people and with different stages, with different degrees of piety, with different degrees of self-restraint. Some human beings are respected and honorable. They are not attracted to temporary material interests. Some are healthy in their bodies, so they engage in more voluntary fasting to obtain greater spiritual rewards.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Different people are there with different, characteristics. And these differences are natural. They are the necessary demands of this material universe. But we should know that according to Islam, rewards and punishments are and will be decided in consideration of man's power and abilities. Man is not held responsible for what he cannot do. Man is not held responsible beyond his capacity. لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا وسعها. And God does not obligate an individual beyond his capacity. Everyone is held responsible and everyone is reckoned and brought to justice based on the capacity and the ability he has. If someone has really no power to understand or to act according to Islamic rules, according to Islamic laws, and if someone has no understanding of the Islamic, doctrines, Islamic teachings, he's excused. And Allah is, of course, most generous. Allah is most merciful. Allah is compassionate. Such people are there. Such people who are incompetent. Such people who do not understand and perceive their obligations and who have no idea whatsoever what their obligation is. They are not guilty in the eye of Allah, and therefore God does not punish such people. But most people are wise enough and they are sufficiently able to understand and follow the right path toward their perfection. They are equipped with the ability and with the power to achieve perfection. They are equipped with the faculty of wisdom, the faculty of intellect. And so, depending on one's ability, a person is held responsible for whatever he does. So, Almighty Allah takes these differences into his consideration when he wants to reward people, when he wants to punish people. He expects more of those people who are given more talents and more ability, capacity as compared to other people. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
The divine judgment, the resurrection, is based on one's capacity. And let's understand that the most pious deed is the most difficult one. أفضل الأعمال أحمزها. And if a person needs more time to learn how to pray or to memorize verses of the Holy Quran. For example, his rewards will be greater and Allah will help him more. And we should understand that, of course, if we suffer in the way of Allah, if we suffer in the way of achieving perfection, and if we suffer in the way of getting closer to Allah, Allah will double the rewards that we achieve. Allah will give us and bestow upon us the rewards that we deserve. So every individual receives the reward based on what he has done and what he has achieved, and based on the proximity and the closeness that he has attained with Allah. Generally speaking, human beings have no difficulty when it comes to power and desire or inclination, which are needed in every decision and action, you know, because man is equipped. Man has the capacity and the necessary power to choose what he has to choose and what he has to do. He has the ability and the power. He has been given the power to achieve knowledge. He has been given the power to achieve perfection. It is he who should actually make his mind up to achieve knowledge, not only of himself and of his soul, but also of his Lord. And most of the problems actually arise from a lack of knowledge. Most of the problems arise from ignorance. Most of the problems arise from a lack of the individual's will to perfect himself. Dear brothers and sisters, there are something which we need to know, and there are some questions that we have to, you know, sometimes encounter in our life and which we have to find answers. First of all, we should know ourselves. How are we created? Why are we created? What are our needs? What are our real desires and our motives? What are our faculties and abilities? Are there any tasks or duties for us? Now, these are some very important questions to encounter, to understand, and then try to find answers to these questions. What is our present situation, and under what conditions do we live? How is our life in this universe? Is it the only life that we have? Is there any eternal life for us? What good or bad qualities do we have? These are questions that we need to answer. These are the basic and the most important questions that we need to answer and that we need to ask ourselves. What is the best position for us? And what values and goods can we acquire? What is a perfect man like? These are also some questions that we need to encounter and to find answers for. Of course, there are more and more questions that we sometimes come across, and sometimes we have to ask ourselves and find answers in order for us to be able to achieve perfection and to achieve a better life. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he
news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Hello everyone, welcome to the light. It's good to have you with us. Asia's largest tulip garden has opened its door to visitors in the Indian-controlled Kashmir 2 years after continued closure due to the outbreak of the COVID-19. Shahana Bhatt reports.
On the banks of Kashmir's famous Dal Lake, surrounded by the majestic Zabarwan mountain range, Asia's largest tulip garden opens for visitors. 1.5 million flowers of 68 varieties have vibrantly colored the earth.
This is heaven, and this place is beyond imagination. After facing lockdown for 2 years, this place is a treat.
Whatever is said in the media and shown is not the truth. The truth is, it is the most secure place to visit.
Kashmir is witnessing bumper tourist season this spring after COVID-19 pandemic lockdown. Administration as well as people expect a bumper tourist season.
We are trying our best, and this year we are lucky in terms of early spring, so that people of Kashmir will have an economic boost.
Following the coronavirus pandemic, the tourists stopped visiting Kashmir, and last 2 years, Kashmir's economy faced a major setback.
Tourism is our backbone of our economy. The money they pump in our economy is manifold for our economy. So that's why our tourist, this tulip garden, it gives impetus to our tourist season. It prepones our tourist season. We have seen the initial response from tourists, particularly from outside UT. We are hoping that this season will be a great season for our tourism sector.
To reclaim the fractured economy, Kashmir's administration has organized a tulip festival to attract more tourists and locals so that the lockdown impact vanishes slowly to conflict-wrecked Kashmir.
After 2.5 years of continued closure due to COVID-19 pandemic, the opening of this garden has brought delight to the people of Kashmir, who for decades have suffered political instability and turmoil. Opening of such spaces helped boost morale and is a good start to a fresh year. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir. If you are an avid fan of traveling, check out this story. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mac Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital Sofia on Wednesday. His first destination, the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he will fly to South Africa and then around the globe to cross the finishing line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
I knew I wanted to do something special in my aviation career, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. It's only once my sister flew around the world that I knew I also wanted to fly around the world.
Mac was born in a family of aviators. His sister Zara became the youngest female pilot to fly solo around the world in a small plane last year. Before setting off on his exciting journey, the young man was seen off by his mother, friends, and sister. If successful, Mac would claim the Guinness World Record as the youngest person who has flown the world solo. He has scheduled to wrap up his journey in July. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, is celebrated worldwide by millions of people, including the people in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The region, known for its natural beauty worldwide, turns magical each year during its spring season. To mark nature's revival, the people of Kashmir have dedicated a day to thank the mesmerizing beauty of spring. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt reports.
As the spring season begins in Kashmir, the earth turns lush green and the trees bear colorful blossoms, with the sky visibly blue and waters clear and glossy. After a not-so-harsh winter this year, the people of Kashmir are welcoming the onset of spring. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, marks the beginning of spring and is celebrated on March 21st. New trees are planted while people offer prayers and seek God's help for a prosperous year.
Each year, we await this season so that we can plant new trees. The process of their growth gives us hope, and that hope teaches us that God has set a time for everything. We can't fast-track it. We can only do our best efforts.
On the occasion of Nowruz, women in Kashmir prepare unique dishes made from lotus stem and fish. Mehra and her sister have a busy day today. Friends and family are invited to relish the moment.
We have been taught by our mothers and grandmothers to cook these delicacies on the special occasion of Nowruz. It requires lots of dedication, and what matters is that this food brings friends and families together, and a lot of positive energy is exchanged. For us, Nowruz is not just an occasion, but it marks a fresh beginning of love, growth, and prosperity.
On the occasion of Nowruz, the Kashmiri administration often organizes musical festivals to add fervor to the celebrations. People, especially children, visit these musical festivals in large numbers so that the year starts with cheerful memories. This year, scores of tourists have also come to witness Kashmir's spring.
We had heard that Kashmir looks magical, but we witnessed in reality that this land looks fabulous, especially the spring season.
The early arrival of tourists has added a lot of positivity to Kashmir's tourism sector, which has been hit hard by years of political instability and turmoil. Persian culture is deeply rooted in Kashmir, and celebrating Nowruz is a sign of its influence.
Nowruz marks a new beginning, and after suffering decades of political instability and 2 years of the COVID pandemic, people are only hoping for a return back to a normal life and an everlasting peace. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Egypt's rich history seems to be a gift that keeps on giving. The country has unveiled some exquisite, newly discovered tombs. The pharaonic tombs were found at the Saqqara archaeological site south of Cairo. The site is a big necropolis of Memphis, an ancient capital of Egypt. The graves belonged to a senior royal official, or rather senior royal officials. Some of the graves are engraved with interesting titles such as Steward of the Royal House and Supervisor of the Garden. The tombs are around 4,000 years old, dating back to the Old Kingdom of Egypt. Turkey inaugurates the world's longest suspension bridge over the Dardanelles Strait. The bridge is more than 2 kilometers long and connects Turkey's European and Asian shores. It cuts travel time between the two locations to just 6 minutes. A consortium of Turkish and South Korean firms began constructing the huge bridge in 2017 with a budget of 2.5 billion euros. 5,000 workers participated in the colossal undertaking. Passenger vehicles must pay a fare of 200 Turkish liras or around 14 US dollars to use the bridge. In Peru, paleontologists have unearthed the skull of a ferocious marine predator that is an ancestor of the modern-day whale. The 36-million-year-old skull was dug up intact after it was discovered in Peru's southern desert. The fossil belongs to an ancient mammal whose contemporary descendants include dolphins. Recreations of how the animal looked like show it mostly resembles a giant lizard that moved like a snake. Paleontologists say it was a top predator measuring some 12 meters long.
The discovery is very important because the skull is in a perfect state of preservation. The skull and the jaw are in a right anatomical position. The teeth are complete. It's very possible this might be a new Basilosaurus species. If this is so, there is no other fossil like this one anywhere else in the world.
Salas further explained when the ancient animal died, its skull might have sunk to the bottom of the seafloor, where it was quickly preserved. The skull, measuring 1.3 meters long, was unveiled at Lima's Museum of Natural History. The Peruvian desert is rich in fossils and offers scientists 42 million years' worth of evolutionary evidence. Other fossils found there include the four-legged dwarf whale and sharks, among others.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A painter in Pakistan shifts from trucks to trainers to uncover a hip new canvas for his famous truck art. Haydar Ali says he works on each pair of shoes for up to 4 days, and his paint of choice is mainly acrylic. He also uses other forms of durable material, such as oil paints, to get the job done. The seasoned artist charges select clients $400 for each set. His designs feature intricate bespoke patterns, including flowers, peacocks, and wildly colorful motifs. He says new requests typically arrive every 4 days. Orders for painted trainers started pouring in for the truck artist after a surge of social media interest.
Ideas keep popping up for me, and sometimes clients have ideas. A client came to me from the US asking for a painting on some shoes. I told him an exorbitant fee to discourage him, but he agreed, so I decided, let's do it then.
He has dispatched 8 pairs to various places in Pakistan and abroad since he first started painting trainers in January. Ali comes from a family of truck artists who made a living off of painting lorries. He came to international fame when his work was exhibited at a museum in the U.S. 2 decades ago. So far, the veteran truck artist has applied his craft to an airplane as well as a passenger car, among others. The art form is mainly seen on Pakistani trucks, and today, the trade is one of the country's most famous cultural exports.
Archaeologists have discovered a 500-year-old Aztec altar with 164 in Mexico City, Mexico's largest starfish offering discovered to date. Archaeologists believe it was built around the year 1500. Jaguar bones and other remains such as seashells were also found. Scientists believe the fossils found correspond to a species known as chocolate chip sea star or Nidorella armata.
This is really interesting because if you think about it, chocolate chip sea star looks like the skin of a jaguar. It's orange with dark spots. Probably that is why this species was selected, but we still need to analyze all the starfish because we found 160 of them and we think they all belong to the same species. But we need to research further every one of them.
According to experts, the location of the altar within the Templo Mayor complex and the jaguar motifs suggest the offering was related to the war. Mexico is brimmed with archaeological sites of several civilizations, including Aztecs. Retired racehorses could be retrained for a new role as so-called therapy horses. According to a study led by the University of Bristol, veterans and disabled children, as well as those struggling with mental health issues, can benefit from the therapy horses. The 3-year study aims to provide a global standard for the racing industry and a toolkit for retraining racehorses. A racehorse's career can last anywhere between 2 and 10 years, but better could be done to make use of these beautiful creatures soon after they're retired.
So racehorses, when they finish their racing careers, and they can finish as young as sort of 3 or 4 years old, they really don't want to be just standing around in fields for the next 20, 30 years. And they're so versatile that I really believe there's a job for 99% of them. I think there's almost a sixth sense with the horse. People needing therapy, whether that's mental health or physical disabilities, there seems to be sort of something that gels between a horse and a human.
Horse trainers say with the thoroughbred's lifespan between 25 to 30 years, this study's aim is crucial for their long-term welfare. Over 7,000 racehorses end their career every year in Britain, with many going into eventing and pleasure riding.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
¶¶
IRIB English Radio.